All right. Hello to everyone out there. This is Kerry Sullivan with TriathlonSummit.com. And today I have a man named Mike Ricci. And Mike is a very accomplished coach for sure. He's a USA Triathlon Level 3 coach. There's not many of those out there in the world. And he is also the founder of D3 Multisport. You can actually check out his website at d3multisport.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome Mike Ricci to the call. How you doing, Mike?
Hey, thanks, Kerry. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thanks for coming, man. We appreciate it, for sure.
It'll be a lot of fun.
Good deal. So let's start with a question that a lot of athletes kind of struggle to figure out, whether they're, you know, experienced or beginner triathletes, and that's judging how much should they do in terms of volume, days, how many days should they train, and all that good stuff. So let's start with that question.
That's a great question, and one that I probably get, you know, twice a week from an email or something like that. But, you know, that question, you know, it always goes down to, you know, a couple things, first of all. Like, you know, how much time do you have to train, first of all, right? So,
yeah.
You know, I'll get these elaborate plans from people that are like, hey, I'm going to train 25 hours. And you look, and they've got a full-time job and kids and, you know, all that, and they commute for 4 hours a day and whatever it is, and then all of a sudden you're like, well, you got 6 hours to train. You know, you can't train 25 hours. So, you know, how do we make the best of those 6 hours? So that's kind of, you know, that's the first thing is how many hours you train. And then secondly, what's their experience? You know, sometimes you have people that, you know, they've done youth swimming or equestrian type stuff, or, you know, maybe they only did it till they were 12 or 14. But they've done, you know, 10, 15, 20-hour weeks as a youth. And to jump back into that in their 30s, you know, maybe they can't get to that level right away, but maybe they don't have a problem, you know, maintaining 12 to 15 hours. Whereas you have someone who's like, you know, they've been pretty much the couch potato their whole life and they're getting off the couch, they're certainly not going to be doing, you know, 15 hours a week. And for those people, you know, maybe it's a half hour, 45 minutes or an hour a day, something to that effect. It doesn't have to be anything too crazy. But, you know, it depends on what the responsibilities are, how much time they have to train, and then how many days a week, you know, that's, I like to give people a day off, or I kind of sneak a day off in there where maybe Friday morning they have an early swim and then they don't do the next workout on Saturday till over 24, 25 hours later, and maybe the same thing on a Sunday where they may finish up by noontime and then they don't have a swim again till like Monday night, so they have like 30 hours off. So they still get the day off. It's just not a complete day, and sometimes people need a mental break from training like that, and sometimes they don't. So, I mean, it just depends on the individual, I guess.
Sure. Let's talk about recovery. I think it's an area that's not fully recognized all the time for its importance. So let's talk about recovery and some of the techniques you like to use with athletes.
Sure. I mean, just, you know, starting with the basic stuff, you know, massage as often as you can. If you can do it weekly, every 10 days, every 2 weeks, once a month, whatever it is, that'll help you. I know whenever I feel a niggle, I'll go, you know, see my massage therapist and he works it out instead of getting injured. So that helps recovery right there. Obviously stretching, people kind of, you know, poo-poo it, but, you know, I find that when I stretch and my athletes stretch, injuries pop up a lot less and it actually helps recovery because it just takes, the load off the muscles. Yoga consistently is great. And then, you know, the newer stuff, you got like the compression tights and the socks and all that stuff. And I just did a trip and I wore my compression socks the whole way. And I was seated for about, 16 hours or so. And by the time I got to my destination, I mean, I took my socks off. I didn't have any swelling in my feet, any swelling in my calves. And I'm like, this is a really good tool. So, you know, it's not, you know, I put a pair of pants on. Nobody knew I had the goofy, you know, socks on. And everything was fine. And then the other thing I really like to do is I know here in Boulder, everybody kind of jumps in the creek because the creek's like 45, 50 degrees, but cold water baths or even just fill in a big garbage can, you know, line it with a plastic bag and then put a bunch of ice and cold water in it and stand in that for, you know, 5 or 10 minutes after you finish a long ride or long bike, because that'll help you, you know, recover as well.
Cool. Great tips
And then I guess, you know, there's also the nutritional side of it, and, you know, that's kind of something to eat as soon as you're done with the workout too, so.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, there's also a lot of training tools out there. You know, you get power meters, heart rate monitors, all that stuff. So what are some of the tools out there that you like to use?
Well, I think, you know, the tools are always great, and I think we use them all. You know, we use the Halo Trainer. We use CompuTrainer. We use PowerTap and SRMs, and we had Ergomo when those guys were in business. Training Peaks we use, which is a great tool for feedback between the coach and the athlete. WKO Plus to, you know, analyze power files and heart rate monitor files, run files. And that's all great stuff, but you've got to do the testing with it. I mean, if you don't do the testing and you can't see what the improvements are, then really the tools are kind of useless. And I know a lot of guys, and professionals, that go out there and they ride the power meter, like, oh, I averaged, you know, 280 watts on my ride today. And I'm like, well, how did it compare to last time you did that ride? Oh, I don't know. I don't save the downloads. I just, you know, I delete them off my computer. And it's like, well, unless you're, you know, following it, it's kind of tough to even, you know, rationalize why you even use those tools. So the tools, you know, you use a lot of different tools. I mean, I've used, I use a snorkel from Finice. I use their tempo trainer. I mean, there's so many great tools to use, but, you know, you got to log how you're using it and what the results are and then go back and, you know, every 4 weeks or 6 weeks, whatever it is, and just kind of say, hey, how did I do last time versus this set, you know? So, you know, tools are great, and we use all of them probably, but, you know, it's just, I think, a matter of making sure they're used properly.
Cool. All right. In terms of, there's a lot of different types of running techniques out there and theories on what the best way to run is. So what's your personal opinion on all that?
Well, it's kind of funny because I grew up kind of running. You know, I played, you know, ball sports and, you know, basketball and football, baseball and all that. And then I ran track here and there in high school. And I just always thought that the way you ran was the way you ran. I never really thought to change it much. And I've always had, like, lower leg issues with certain things, with calf problems and kind of things like that. So I ran into a guy named Bobby McGee, and I don't know if you've had him on the show, but you should. He's a great, great coach, international run coach, and he's coached an Olympic gold medalist in a marathon in the 96 Olympics. And you know, he just said, you got to do this, you got to do this, and I was just, like, blown away. And his style is not quite like Poe's method. There's a lot of similarities to it. But it's not quite like that. A lot of the things he talks about, you know, are just making sure, you know, you roll off the front of your feet, the front of your big toe, and, you know, you roll, you know, have a good arm swing, you lean forward a little bit. I mean, just simple little things. And he's got all these little tools when you go to his run drill sessions that we use. And that's kind of what I've hooked on to. And I've seen him help a lot of people that have had injuries in the past, straighten them out by just going for a half-hour session with Bobby, and he straightened them out. So I think that, you know, his run style is kind of what I like to give my athletes, and I've seen it work really well, so I don't really use anything else. I've got some issues with the pose stuff. I've got some issues with some of that other stuff that's out there, but, you know, for the most part, I think running is pretty straightforward, but everybody needs to be tweaked a little bit, just like your swim stroke. I mean, obviously, you know, we all swim differently, but there's different flexibility for people, and not everybody can swim the same way. And the same thing for running. Not everybody's going to have the same gait, whether it be, you know, maybe they have an offset hip situation or something like that where they're not going to be able to stride as much, or, you know, just flexibility has a lot to do with a lot of the things and a lot of the techniques that we use. And if we can even achieve, you know, some of the techniques we see with, like, a Michael Phelps or some of these better runners. So that's kind of – I'm kind of in the – I try to take the best of everybody. I mean, that's kind of what I do. You know, I don't hang my hat on anybody absolutely, but, you know, Bobby's the guy in terms of what he's done to help me and my athletes.
Cool. All right, let's talk a little bit about swimming technique then, and as there are some different methods out there as well, and what you like to use.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's kind of interesting, especially in Olympic year, you always see all these videos floating around the internet, and people are like, hey, look at Michael Phelps, and look at Ian Thorpe, and look how they swim. And, you know, they don't think about the size. You know, these guys are, first of all, they're 6'5", and they have size 17, 18 foot. And, you know, they're kicking almost with fins. If it were us, it would be like we're kicking with fins on, and they're kicking into their stroke. So it's very easy for them to catch. You know what I mean? So they put their hand out there, and then their massive feet kick, and all of a sudden they roll right into their catch, and they grab a whole bunch of water. You know, and of course they're fast. I mean, they're built to swim. I mean, the flexibility in these guys is just incredible. But, you know, there's obviously the old school S-stroke style, which a lot of swimmers use and a lot of coaches still teach. And then from what I learned, it kind of came from the Aussies, but it was the straight arm pullback. And I think with good rotation, that stroke works just fine, and that's actually what I use. I've never really liked to do the F-stroke because I find that a lot of people tend to cross over underneath. And I've seen good swimmers that still cross over, but for some reason they can still, you know, swim 105, 100 for some reason. But but that's just because they've been doing it since they're 4 years old, right? So their body's adapted to it. So in terms of technique, I think, you know, whenever I have a lesson, and I probably teach once or twice a week in terms of a one-on-one lesson, and I have a couple of groups that I coach on deck every week, But what I've learned is that you can't put everybody in the same box in swimming. So you can't say to everybody, hey, you need to learn the S-stroke, you know, get a high elbow and, you know, pull back, because not everybody can get in that position. So when people aren't flexible enough like that, I'll teach them to just kind of pull straight back, but to rotate a lot so they don't put a lot of stress on their shoulders. So it's just, you know, it's really a case-by-case basis. And some people, if they're really new to swimming but they're really athletic, typically I can teach them like an S-stroke type of thing where I can get them to really catch and get their elbow high. But some people maybe, you know, they keep dropping their elbow, so I got to teach them just go straight in a 45-degree angle and just, you know, pull back as hard as you can. And usually that works for some people as well. So it's kind of a case-by-case basis, I guess. You know, it's not everybody has the same flexibility, and that's what people need to understand when they look at these superstar swimmers, because not everybody's been swimming since they were 6 years old like Michael Phelps and, you know, doing, you know, 15,000 yards a day since he was 10 probably or something, you know.
Yeah, for sure. All right, actually, let's talk a little bit about cycling technique too. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, interesting. I always read the studies on it, and you know, lately there's been a lot of stuff coming out of the U.S. Cycling, studies they've done. They're saying that, you know, there's no such thing as pulling up on your stroke, and really what you need to work on is, you know, coming over the top and then pressing down, and that makes sense. And then if you use a tool like Power Cranks, it really shows you, you know, why it's optimal to pull up and push down to even the stroke out. You know, same thing as using a fixed gear bike. Because you're constantly pedaling. I think, you know, and then there are people that talk about pedaling in squares. You know, go across the top, straight down, along the bottom, and up the back. So definitely different styles. I tend to think that an even stroke all the way around is pretty beneficial, but I do believe that 11 o'clock, if it's on your right foot, that 11 o'clock to 1 o'clock, bringing the foot up and over the top of the pedal stroke is really important, because once you get it there, you know, going down, you know, you're going with gravity, so it's a lot easier to push down, and then, you know, scraping the mud off the bottom of your foot along the bottom of the stroke is key. So I do think that top piece of the stroke is really important. With the rest of it, you know, the jury's kind of out on whether you should be pushing down or pulling up, but once you get the momentum going, I think that's kind of the key piece, and that's really the hip flexor. You know, it's pulling it up and then getting it over that top, and then, you know, that's where a tool like, you know, the Power Cranks or a fixed gear bike or doing single leg drills really is important. And you know, they've done studies to say that this stuff doesn't work in terms of like the single leg drill, but I tend to think it does, because there's really no other way to work the hip flexors unless you're doing something really explosive, which triathletes tend not to do. So
Definitely. I got a set of Power Cranks. I'm a fan. So good deal.
What's that?
I said I get a set of Power Cranks. Use them. I'm a fan. So.
Oh yeah, sure. I do too, and I think they're great. I really do. And you know, I just did a triathlon a couple weeks ago, and I wasn't really expecting to run well, and my running's been kind of you know, not as good as it's been in the past. And what I ran, I ran the 6:30s, and I was like, how the heck did that happen? And I'm thinking maybe it was the Power Cranks, you know. So maybe there's, I'm gonna post it on my blog over there. So we'll see.
yeah. You know, it's funny because it almost seems like, the more I wear my legs out on those, and then, like, if I do a brick, like, the better I run. It's weird.
It is so hard to run off a brick on those things. It's like.
Yeah, but you run good.
Yeah, you do.
Or I run good, so I don't know.
Yep.
It's interesting stuff. All right. Let's talk a little bit about the off-season and basically how long is this time during the year and how should it be used to be most effective?
Right. Well, you know, the off season, it's just it's one of those things that, you know, I tend to think that once you go to a fall race and you peak and you have a great race, I find it really hard to let go of that fitness, because that is your peak for the year, and, you know, probably some people it's even a lifetime peak. So you don't want to lose all that fitness. I mean, I tend to think, you know, you need 2 to 4 weeks of just downtime away from swim, bike, run, certainly. You know, do some other stuff, though, whether it be cross-country ski or, you know, do some hiking or rafting. But, you know, do something aerobic, but it doesn't have to be, you know, sport-specific, like, you know, get in and swim X number of yards or bike so many miles or run so many Ks or whatever. But just go in there and just with the sense of, I'm going to do something for an hour a day or whatever it is, 45 minutes a day. Just get yourself going a little bit. And then once you start the off-season, I like to, you know, for me, the off-season depends on when you start hitting certain benchmarks, right? So if you end the season and you're averaging, say, 250 watts on the bike And then, you know, we got your threshold to 250, you know, just doing aerobic work with a little bit of maybe VO2, and it's mid-January. Well, then it might be time to, you know, start doing some harder stuff. Because you can always come back and do another block. You know, so say your A race is, whatever, 12 weeks away, and you do, like, a four-week block of LT, and then do, like, a couple easy weeks again, maybe high-volume aerobic, and then go back and do some LT again. Well, you probably just got an extra couple weeks of LT work in. So I think that's beneficial, you know, but it matters on when, you know, the athlete hits the benchmarks, and then that would really determine, you know, how long the off season is versus just saying it's going to be 12 weeks. Because, I mean, I've had off seasons where I've gone, you know, 24 weeks. I started, like, late September, and I've gone 6 months of I just keep improving on, you know, doing, you know, just longer runs and building the volume. And then I would throw in, you know, some track work toward the A race, and yeah, I've had good result from that, you know, so... it's really just personal. It's personal, and it just matters on when, you know, when you start seeing those benchmarks or get close to them, and you're like, okay, you're ready for the next step. You know, it's like trying to tell somebody, hey, you're going to do 6 weeks of weightlifting, and by the sixth week, you're going to be, you know, hitting your max on your deadlifts or something, or, you know, leg press. And even if you're not, we're moving on to the next phase. But you got to let that person hit that, you know, peak, and then you move on, because I think a lot of times people set things in stone too much. But you know, just letting the athlete dictate. You know, it, hitting those benchmarks and then moving on to the next phase of training.
Cool. All right. Let's discuss the next question, and that is, how can you run faster off the bike? It's something that pretty much everybody wants to do. So why don't you discuss that?
Yeah. So, you know, without a power meter, you know, with a power meter, without a power meter, it's still the same business, right? I mean, it just means getting stronger on the bike and knowing that, you know, you did it, you know, a climb or a ride, and you did it at X heart rate, and you went faster, right? And if you have a power meter, obviously you can measure watts, so that makes things a lot simpler. In terms of, you know, how do you run faster off the bike? Well, you know, you have to be able to, you know, pace the bike well and hit your nutrition. Once you can do those two things, then you're going to run well off the bike. If you're talking, you know, longer the distance, the more important that is. Obviously, in a sprint race, you know, you can absolutely drill yourself into the ground, and then if you have decent fitness, you can get off and run, you know, well. If you want to run really well, maybe you know, back off 5%, and then you run, you know, X percent better. The thing with the sprint and the Olympic as age groupers is that everybody, you know, everybody has that nice bike, and they don't want to get beat by their neighbor, so they got to, like, drill that bike split. So, you know, they just cry, hey, I biked, you know, 102, but, you know, then they ran 55 minutes for a 10K. So is that really that good? You know,
yeah.
But, hey, I got a nice bike, and I got great wheels, and I paid a lot for it, and look, it goes fast. But,
yeah,
you know, 45 people beat me to the finish line. So, you know, is that, you know, is that really a good payoff? Probably not. So it's just a matter of figuring out how, you know, how hard am I going to go and, you know, and have that good run. And I like to see people, you know, do some testing in terms of just go out there, like, say, maybe go, you know, go do a 10-mile time trial on your bike and then go to the track and run 3 miles at, you know, say, 5 beats below LT. And then maybe the next week go out there and do the same bike and then go to the track and do the same bike with, like, a little harder, a little less effort, and then go to the track and run the same run. And if you run a little faster, well, maybe, you know, you've given up a little bit on the bike, but maybe you're getting more on the run. So the key to running off the bike well is obviously nutrition and then pacing. But in terms of, you know, doing how many numbers of bricks you need to do, I kind of think that stuff's overrated. I don't think you need to do a ton of bricks. I think if you do one every 2 weeks, I think you're probably fine. Once you start racing and you're racing, you know, once every 2 weeks or once every 3 weeks, your body understands what's going on, and you're not going to get faster running off the bike by doing more bricks. You're going to get faster running by doing faster running. I mean, that's how it's going to work. And doing those track workouts, you know, doing those key workouts fresh, like doing, you know, so the way I've always set it up for years and, you know, 20-plus years, the way I've done it is, you know, Monday is usually an easy recovery day, and then Tuesday is the hardest workout of the week, which is the run workout, the hard run workout, whereas the track workout. And then that is the freshest you're going to be all week, because obviously when you get to Thursday, you've already got 2 weeks, you know, harder days in. The weekends are longer. Those aren't going to be easy days. You got to do that as soon as you can and get it done on Tuesday. So in my opinion, you know, it's get the hard run done early, and then, you know, be able to pick up that pace off the bike. But that bike fitness is so key too. So you got to figure out, you know, where you're losing on the bike as well, because once that bike fitness comes up, usually it's a lot easier to run off the bike too, because you're putting out the same effort, you know, you're out there less time. I mean, obviously, if you're doing a three-hour half Ironman and then you get your fitness to where you're going 245, well, that's 15 less minutes around the bike. That's going to save you a lot of energy, and you should run. You should run much better. You know, it's less calories, all of it. So, yeah, I think that, you know, those are kind of the key components there to run off the bike well.
Good deal, good deal. And Mike, where can people find your information for coaching and things like that in D3 Multisport?
Yeah, it's d3multisport.com, and then you can just click on coaching, and there's, you know, it'll show you all 8 coaches that we have, and all their information, and, you know, the certifications and all that stuff. And, you know, I think one of the things that we do well is that we customize everything, and, you know, you don't just get, you know, 8 weeks in a row. We'll give you, you know, 2 weeks, 3 week blocks, and if you need to make changes, you know, our coaches are more than happy to do that. And you know, the thing with us is we don't have a lot of turnover because we've just have created such great relationships with our athletes, and I think that's a testament to the coaches and the kind of people they are, and you know, how hard they work. So it's been great, and it's been a lot of fun seeing these coaches come on and really do a good job for us.
Cool, good deal. All right, so, you know, Kona is it's kind of the holy grail for a lot of people. And so let's say an athlete comes to you and is just like, all right, Mike, I want to go to Kona. So what do you do? What's your game plan?
I get this every year. I get one guy every year that does this, and I kind of put him aside as my special project, and then I work with him. And that's kind of my thing. I've had this happen a number of times. And, you know, what I always do is I assess their weaknesses and their strengths. And, you know, I had this guy come to me a couple of years ago, and it was the end of 2005, and he's like, I want to go to Kona. I'm doing Ironman Arizona in April. And I'll tell you exactly what I did. And I said, okay, well, let's go there, and let's just see how it goes, and I'm just going to give you, you know, a basic build-up. And, you know, I could see he was getting faster, and he needed to lose a little weight, and you know, but he was doing well. And there's a little bit of background in mountain biking, no running, no swimming background, but that was it. And he went out there, and he went just under 11 hours. So he went like 10:56 and ran about 4 hours. So, you know, he was like, I just can't believe how hard it was. And I'm like, well, that's why I want you to just experience it, you know. So then I said, you know, we got a three-year plan here. So that's the way I look at it. So the next year we focused on improving his run. So he went to Lake Placid, and I believe he ran a 3:23 off the bike. So from 4 hours at Arizona, which was fast, flat, to a 3:23 in Lake Placid. But we really focused on the run. We gave him 3 key run workouts a week, which he was able to handle. He's biked the same exact time that he biked in Arizona. So he biked a 5:50 at both places, but obviously Lake Placid was harder. So we saw how much his fitness improved, and he was 11 minutes off a qualifying slot. So now we know the next year he's going to make it, right? Because all we got to do is tweak his bike a little bit. So the next winter is just all bike, 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 bike. And then he went to Coeur d'Alene last year, and he, you know, he got his slot. And he ran like a 3:09. So as his bike, you know, as his bike improved, so did his run. You know, so that's why I'm saying, you know, I know for a fact that once you're on that bike less, it's going to be a lot easier to run well. So what I like to do is just kind of look at, you know, where are they and where do they want to go and how long, you know, they want to do it. I have plenty of people that come to me in February and say, hey, I'm going to Canada. I want to qualify for Hawaii. And I'm like, well, that's like 8 months away, you know, or 7 months away. That's really hard to do if you haven't, you know, especially if you've done an Ironman, you're like a 12-hour guy and you need to get to like 10:30 or 10:15. That's really tough. And I've had people do that, you know, and you're just kind of like, hey, this is a 2-year plan. No, I don't have 2 years. I want to do it this year. And it's like, well, you know, you got to be realistic. That's the big thing with people. And just and most of the people, you know, they're business people, and, you know, they understand how it works. And they understand that, you know, there's no such thing as overnight success. It just doesn't happen. You know, I read something the other day about it was Outliers, and they're saying the Beatles had practiced, you know, 10,000 hours before they came to the U.S., and they became an overnight success. Well, yeah, how many hours had they played before they were an overnight success, you know? So there's no such thing. So just look at where they need to go and, you know, what are their weaknesses. So the swim is the first thing I like to get out of the way. So, you know, I'll build them up to a 5,000-yard swim over the course of, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 months. And then, you know, once I say, okay, we got that in the 110 range, 105 range, let's just maintain that, and then let's work on the big piece, which is the bike, all right, because that's the hardest piece and the biggest piece. And then you start working on that. And if they're a decent biker and if they're running, then, you know, sometimes you got to take those good bikers and you got to kind of hold them back and say, listen, I know you can bike 5:10, but you need to bike 5:30 so you can run a 3:30 or run a 3:25 or whatever it is to qualify. So that's kind of the tricky piece right there, is when you have someone who's good at one sport and tell them to kind of temper their effort down a little bit. But then once you get the pieces together and you do some half Ironmans, they start seeing that, wow, they're not going 450 anymore. Now they're in the 430 range, 425 range. Then they're kind of like, wow, I think I can do this. You know, and it's instilling that confidence. So it's a bunch of pieces that kind of fit together. And like everything, there's no one formula. But it's just a matter of, you know, trial and error on some things. And sometimes they'll say, hey, let's try this for 6 weeks. If we see results, then great. If we don't, then we don't do it. You know, we'll stop it. So it's a lot of different things. But I think just, you know, kind of recognizing the strengths, the weaknesses, and, you know, what's their time frame. That's always the big thing. And then, you know, how many hours can they train? That's the other piece, too. So.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's talk a little bit about nutrition and the importance of that, because you're kind of talking about that with the bike. So why don't you go on about that for a while?
Yeah, so nutrition in terms of, like, racing or outside of racing?
Let's talk about racing, actually, and then
we can talk about
outside, too.
Yep, I'm a big proponent of, you know, liquids. Don't eat a lot of bars on the bike. I know people that do. I will do some gels here and there. We've been using Infinite for a number of years now. They're a great product, and it's customized, so that's a great way to go. That's Infinite Nutrition. And the key, you know, knowing how many calories you need, you know, per hour, I think is such a huge advantage. I think that's one of the ways that a power meter works so well, because you know how many calories you're burning or how many calories, you know, you burn over 5 or 6 hour ride. And you know that, you know, if you're burning, you know, 800 calories an hour and 50% are from fat, then, you know, you need to replace right around, you know, 300-400 calories an hour, whatever it is. I mean, the other side of that is, you know, getting a fuel test done and knowing what your caloric burn rate is for, you know, carbohydrates versus fats is huge too. That's a huge advantage as well. So, I mean, knowing that you have to put exactly, you know, 263 calories back per hour is awesome, because then you know you're not screwing around with 200 or 350 or whatever it is. So, in terms of fueling, I mean, fueling is everything. And you know, when I look back to when I started and I did my first Ironman back in very early 90s, it was bananas and Big Newtons. And the reason I used Big Newtons was because they had a little bit of fat, but not a lot of fat. There was a little bit of protein, not a lot of protein. And if you look at, like, what they're, you know, how they're made up now compared to, like, you know, a drink from Gatorade or something like, or, you know, even some Hammer products, it's pretty close in how much protein they have and how much carbs are in it and all that. So it's kind of interesting that actually worked for a while. You can just only eat so many Fig Newtons. That's the problem over, you know, 112 miles. But, you know, there really weren't a lot of drinks back then. There might have been, like, Cytomax or something like that, but none of it tasted very good. So it was always solid food. But knowing, you know, now it's so easy to say, you know, I'm going to create two bottles on the bike, and I'm going to measure them off in fifths, say, and I'll pour it in my aero bottle and then pour some water in there, and then I know I have my concentrate for the next hour or so, you know. But, you know, fueling on that, you know, on that bike is really going to, you know, impact your run, obviously, because if you get off that bike underfueled, and, you know, you can't put that many calories down on a run. Maybe you can only put down, you know, 150, 200 calories an hour when you're running, you know, harder, you know, say 10K half Ironman, you're running at a pretty decent effort. You got to be fueled coming off the bike, otherwise it's going to be a big problem. Once you get to Ironman, obviously, you're at a lower heart rate. You can take in maybe a few more calories, but you get to the point then where, you know, you're 6, 7, 8, 9 hours into a race, and maybe your stomach's kind of like, not really in the mood for it anymore. And then it starts to shut down because there's too much sugar, too much something else, or maybe you're just sick of whatever you're eating, you know. But, nutrition is just one, you know, besides pacing, is the biggest piece of actually doing well at the longer events. Being underfueled is just, you know, it's a recipe for disaster, you know, getting on that run. And I've done it. I mean, I've gone out there and, you know, gone out with not enough sodium and have cramping the first 3 miles of a half Ironman, and then all of a sudden down a bunch of Gatorade and, you know, that I'm on my way. So, I mean, there's just, you know, it's that fueling piece is just such a big piece of it.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, let's talk about away from training then, and away from racing, and nutrition, and how that is important.
You know, I'm kind of along the lines of, you know, you got to, I think, you know, rewarding yourself with, you know, a little treat every once in a while is fine. I know I used to do this thing. I'm not as disciplined as I once was, but I used to be disciplined enough to say that if I hit all my workouts during the week, then, you know, Friday at lunchtime at work, I'd go out and get, you know, me a big sub sandwich or something to that effect. whatever it was at the time. You know, I think that stuff's fine as long as you're doing the work and putting the hours in. I don't think it's something you should do every day, but, you know, if you want to say, hey, I want to have a little tiramisu on a Sunday night or something like that, if you hit all your workouts, I think that's fine. You know, for the most part, I think you need to eat, you know, whole foods, and, you know, that has, you know, it has to be, you know, fruits and vegetables and, you know, lean meats and things of that nature, you know, big salads with, you know, good oils in them, or avocados and nuts and, you know, just the usual basics, like, you know, whatever they've called the caveman diet, I think is great. I think carbs are, you know, carbs certainly have a place in your world. And if you don't have those carbs, you're not gonna race well, because there's no way you're gonna restore glycogen. So you need to eat carbs during rides. You need to eat, you know, before and after workouts. You should definitely have carbohydrates. I'm a big proponent of coming home after a big swim and having a huge bowl of oatmeal. And I'm certainly not getting fat from doing that. You know, it's good for you. You know, put a little bit of honey on it or whatever. But, you know, basics are the way to go. You know, stay away from the processed stuff, because that's the stuff that is really not good. I'm actually reading a book called Omnivore's Dilemma right now that's incredible, and it talks about how much corn is in every single thing you eat. And every night I read about 10 or 15 pages before I go to bed, and I close the book and I look over my wife and I'm like, okay, that's about five more things I'm not eating. I mean, it's amazing what corn is in every single thing you eat. And it just makes me want to eat apples the rest of my life, you know, and that's it. So, it's kind of funny.
Yep. You know? Yep. No, I've been seeing some things like that very recently too. So it's interesting stuff for sure.
I think we're getting more educated, which is great. So.
Yeah, definitely. And a lot of people like you are sharing all kinds of good stuff with everyone here, so
we
appreciate that for sure, man. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Kevin? Or, sorry, Mike.
Oh, no worries. Yeah, I think that's about it. You know, the other side of the nutrition thing I just wanted to add was that, you know, whenever you're having a meal, you should always have good fats with whatever you're eating, you know. So if you're having a salad, make sure you have an avocado. If you're having a banana or something, have a little bit of peanut butter, because that's always important too. But no, I think this has been great. I appreciate you having me on, and it's been a lot of fun.
Well, thanks for coming on. And,
right,
Mike, where can people find your stuff again?
It's at d3multisport.com, or they can email me at mike@d3multisport.com. And just want to put a little blurb in for I've started an under-23 team here in Boulder. So if anybody is between the ages of 19 and 23 and interested in triathlon, they can shoot me an email, and we've got 3 workouts a week, and we'll be going all summer long, and it'll be a lot of fun. It's a great group of kids.
Awesome. Good deal. All right. Thanks again, Mike, for coming on.
Okay.